The Tom Woods Show, episode 1718.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're considering homeschooling, you know I recommend the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, for which I created 400 videos. It's an excellent education in all the standard subjects, plus personal finance for teens, how to be an effective public speaker, how to run a home business, the kinds of things nobody teaches, but they darn well should. Not to mention, it's self-taught, so you get your sanity back as a parent. Make sure you join at my special link, because only there do you get my $160 worth of free bonuses you can't get anywhere else. Check it out at ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I am happy and proud to say that I have given you an almost virus-free week this week, apart from a brief mention of it in the Michael Malice episode. In episode, I guess that was number 1716, it's been virus-free. So it's almost like the world is normal, even though we know it isn't. But I still feel compelled to say a couple of quick things before we get to today's topic. Number one, when last week, or maybe it was a week and a half ago, Dr. Scott Atlas was brought on board to the White House to advise on the virus, I was reading the AP's coverage of this, and the AP sounds like MSNBC. I guess I don't read enough mainstream media to have noticed this, but it was obviously an advocacy piece for a point of view. I couldn't believe it. It was, he has no experience in public health and this and that, which, by the way, is refreshing, given that I would say what we've discovered from all this is the utter corruption of the public health establishment, if we didn't know that already, and how power-hungry these people are with their clipboards and their crazy wild extrapolations that have nothing to do with reality. And I think it's positively welcome that the guy has a medical background but doesn't have the shovel people around like concrete attitude that public health so-called people seem to have. But anyway, I was particularly struck by when the AP said that Scott Atlas had falsely claimed that children were at near zero risk. What? First of all, falsely, they would never say Obama falsely claimed anything. That would not have been said in a direct reporting piece like this. But secondly, children are at near zero risk. How is that even debatable? Look at the numbers. Children are at near zero risk. He falsely claimed that? What's the defense of that going to be? Well, you know, there were 12 deaths or something, but that's near zero when we're dealing with tens of millions. Absolutely crazy. So, by the way, I'm kind of getting on the Ron Paul bandwagon these days because I'd kind of fallen out of what he was up to. But geez, they did an episode recently over on the Ron Paul Liberty Report, both on Scott Atlas and then one on Sweden, which is really important, by the way, because the narrative now is, yeah, Sweden may have no deaths now, but boy, they really sacrificed a lot of lives because they refused to lock down. Look, talk about missing the point, right? If the virus had really been so severe and the lockdown so absolutely necessary as to justify the bizarre, ad hoc, irrational destructionism of the past 5 months, then Sweden's more or less lackadaisical approach should have killed an enormous number of people. It shouldn't be comparable to the UK. It should have been 1,000 times worse than anywhere. But the other point is, the vast majority, something like 75% of the deaths there, were in one way or another connected to some type or another of long-term care facility. And they admit they failed on that. But that has nothing to do with how their strategy affected the ordinary course of day-to-day life. Those facilities are cut off from society. How did society do? That's the question we should be curious about. And then in that case, they did great. And I've shared the statistic that in terms of people under 50 who died from the virus, it was 70 out of a country of 10 million people. Yeah, that's pretty good, considering they didn't have to destroy people's lives and put them through this crazy Orwellian, ever-changing series of demands and goalpost shifting and gaslighting, and you got to stay in your house for however many years it takes to develop a vaccine. even though for almost everybody, you wouldn't even notice this pandemic was going on. You would not even notice. But you have to stay in your house until, because you now have an infinitesimally greater risk of death. And since your previous risk of death was exactly where we needed it to be, this means we need to shut your life down. They didn't have to do any of that. And they got this result. So anyway, when I'm not keeping you up to date on this stuff, you can confidently tune into the Ron Paul Liberty Report, and they are keeping you up to date on everything that's going on. So check that out at ronpaullibertyreport.com. All right, we're doing something a little bit different in today's episode. By the way, it's pouring rain outside my house right now, and I don't think the microphone picks that up. But in case you're wondering, it does sound like the world is about to end. That's how driving the rain is. But anyway, I'm going to talk about public speaking today, but I'm going to try to make it interesting for people who don't do public speaking. I mean, virtually anybody at some point or another is going to have to make some kind of presentation, and you may find that it's beneficial to you for whatever reason, professionally or otherwise, and you may wind up doing it more than once. But I want to try to make this of general interest and also have it be something you can draw general lessons from just about persuasion in general, particularly the last couple things I'm going to say about knowing your audience and so on. You can apply that even outside of public speaking setting. But I have a career of 25 years when it comes to public speaking, so I have plenty of experience with this. I have spoken to audiences large and small, enthusiastic and skeptical, all kinds of different people. And I have accumulated some tips over the years as to how to do this effectively. And this is something that terrifies people. Oh my gosh, I don't need to tell you probably how terrifying some people find this. Now, in my case, it helped me a lot that when I was younger, I did a lot of community theater. And in fact, the last play I was in was about 12 years ago, so it's been a while, 2008. Or no, I beg your pardon, 2008. I was writing the book Meltdown, which came out in 2009. And while I did that, I was also playing Vinny, a minor character in The Odd Couple in the Auburn Area Community Theater. And I had a great time. Now, I was disappointed that I didn't get the role of Oscar, which I really wanted. But in a way, thank goodness I didn't get a role that big, because there's no way I could have balanced memorizing all those lines against writing Meltdown, my book on the financial crisis that I wrote so quickly. I would have had to sacrifice one of them. So it's just as well I had the smaller role. But anyway, obviously community theater puts you at ease in front of an audience. And also being a college professor, which I was for 7 years, puts you at ease in front of a group of people. But I started my career as a public speaker while I was in graduate school, so even before I was a professor. So I kind of relish being in front of an audience. But even I, as somebody who's, as I said, spoken for 25 years, get nervous sometimes before I go out, particularly if I know that the audience is likely to be at least somewhat hostile. Yeah, I get nervous. You never know what can happen. But once I get out there, it generally works out all right. So let's talk here. Let's give some advice, offer some observations. Generally, people have a fear of public speaking, and we need to try to figure out how to overcome that fear. So I want to start off right there. Where do you get confidence from? Because, of course, confidence will overcome your fear. When you're confident in your ability to do something, you tend not to be terrified of doing it. So where does that come from? That comes from, number one, practice, repeat performances. Now, you may not have a lot of opportunities to engage in public speaking. So the way to do this is, and this is very standard advice, but it doesn't mean it's wrong, to look up Toastmasters and find your local chapter, because there you're going to find a lot of people who are in your situation. They want to be better, more confident, and skilled public speakers, and you will make presentations in front of each other and offer constructive criticism to each other. So you'll all grow together, and you'll have ample opportunity to address groups of people. So I highly recommend that. Secondly, I've often said that if you want to be a better writer, and I get people asking me about that, how to be a good writer. I have an episode on that, by the way. Let me jot this down. I don't know if you can hear the paper here. But episode on writing. I'm pretty happy with that, by the way, my advice on becoming a better writer. I've written 12 books. I have some experience with writing also. There are a lot of things I'm terrible at, by the way, more than I can possibly list. But I've had some success with writing and speaking, so I'm going to offer you my advice on those things. So anyway, I'll link to the episode on writing at tomwoods.com/1718. But my advice is somewhat similar in that to become a better writer, one of the things you have to do is read good writers because you unconsciously absorb their good habits and their good style and the way they use English prose. There are no wasted words. Every word is precisely the one that conveys the shade of meaning intended by the author. You get that. I mean, H.L. Mencken would be a great example, but it's a little bit of old-timiness to his writing, I suppose. But I'll give you an example. Somebody like Pat Buchanan. Now, Pat Buchanan you either love or hate, but from my point of view, it does not matter if you love or hate him if you want to become a better writer. Because if you want to become a better writer, read his columns or read his books. They're written really well. The prose is really, really good. Or Thomas Sowell. Now, he's such a good writer that it'll make you despair almost. It'll make you think, I could never be this good. So you don't want it to turn you into a perfectionist such that it paralyzes you, but you do want to, in effect, critique your own writing to the point where you ask, as you're writing, would somebody like Sowell have written a pedestrian sentence like this or not? So anyway, I can't recommend that enough. You read good writing, that helps you become a better writer. That combined with practice. So when it comes to public speaking, we've already talked about the importance of practice. So in the same way that becoming a better writer involves reading good writing, becoming a better speaker can also involve watching good speeches. Now, there are a lot of great TED Talks out there, of course, where the speaker is actually very good. Find somebody who's really good and just keep watching, and you'll get a sense of what makes this person a good speaker. And you'll begin to make note of things like organization and pacing and diction and making eye contact, although we're going to get back to eye contact a little later, but just not looking down at the floor or looking all around the room, but maintaining contact with the audience. You'll pick up on things like this, and you'll find yourself absorbing and adopting these things, sometimes without even realizing it. And that's much better, by the way, than taking one of these public speaking courses that's going to instruct you on how you should gesture and stuff like that. I mean, that's stilted and robotic. Anyway, we'll get to that later. Number three would be just know your stuff. There's no substitute for this. There's no shortcut here. There's no magic dust involved. If you know your stuff, you'll be confident in front of an audience. If you go out into a room and you know there's nobody in this room who knows more than I do on this topic, well, there's nothing better than that in terms of boosting your confidence. Now, here are two things never to do. Never, ever, 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 never do these things, all right? This first one is so crucial never to do. And chances are you've seen someone do it, and man, is it a mistake. Don't ever admit to the audience that you're nervous. Don't ever say, because maybe you stumbled or something, I'm sorry, I'm just nervous. Don't do that. Okay, even if you're terrified, don't do that to the audience. That puts the audience in an awkward position, and you should be putting them at ease. They should be able to sit there and relax and enjoy your presentation. That's why they're there. They don't want to be agitated, worrying if you're going to mess up, and don't do that. It puts you in a bad position too, because now they start pitying you. You do not want to be pitied by the audience. You want to be respected. And if you apologize for being nervous, oh, no, 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 no. Don't. And you know what? That's a general principle. Don't ever apologize to the audience, period. Let's say for some reason you're having an organization problem and you're looking through your notes and you can't find something. Do not apologize for this. Make a joke about it as you're flipping through, but do not apologize. You are in command of that room, or you're supposed to be in command of that room. That is the natural order and natural hierarchy of that room. You are the speaker. You are in charge. You do not apologize to them, unless you take out a gun and murder one of them, in which case you do owe them an apology. But if you do that, or if you admit that you're nervous, the audience is going to look at you differently. And they're not going to walk away feeling impressed. They're going to walk away relieved that it wasn't a complete train wreck. And you don't want to put them in that position. You just soldier on. and do not ever acknowledge nervousness. You can be nervous, but you don't tell them that you're nervous. It's the equivalent of a comedian bombing. When a comedian starts to bomb, it's not impossible for him to claw his way back, but it's very difficult. It's very difficult once the audience has turned on him for the audience to come back and have enough confidence in him that they can be at ease again and laugh. So do not do that. The other thing, never read your speech directly off a paper, even though I understand that's a nice security blanket to have. There's the speech right there. All I have to do is get up there and read. I know how to read out loud, so this is the easiest way to do it. But it's also the easiest way for an audience to lose interest, to dismiss you, to forget about you, for you to appear forgettable. Don't do that, even though it's very tempting. Here's what I do. I bring one piece of paper. Now, there may be times when you see me taking out multiple pieces of paper. The only reason I have multiple pieces of paper is when I have multiple lengthy quotations that I want to read from and or statistics that I want to cite. But generally, I have one piece of paper. And what I often do is take the piece of the pad of paper that's in your hotel room, tends to be a small pad of paper, and I try to write my bullet points just on that small piece of paper. And what I then do is elaborate extemporaneously on those bullet points. Now, I know that sounds intimidating. Like, you don't want to be extemporaneous up there because you're terrified. You're in front of a group of people. But this is something that becomes easier with practice. And also, you should practice doing it before you go up in front of the audience. Now, I generally have on-the-job experience. I don't practice in advance, but that's because I have a lot of experience doing this. That's what I would recommend. Get those bullet points down and then practice elaborating on them. So you don't want to memorize what you're saying, but you want to know that you can, when the chips are down, say something about these various points. Now, later on today, I'm going to talk to you about the best way to organize your talk. And I think this is just a slam dunk, by far best way to do it. So we'll get to that. So again, don't just read it, not only because that's going to bore everybody to death, but also you're never going to get additional speaking offers from somebody in the audience who just watched you read off a piece of paper. You know, anyone can do that. But sometimes you give a good talk, there's somebody in the audience who goes up to you and says, here's my card. I'd love it if you could give a talk like this at my such and such conference. Okay, that's not going to happen if you read. Doors that might have opened for you will stay closed. The outline that I bring up there keeps me on track. It makes sure that if I go off on a tangent, I don't forget where I am. I don't forget what my next point should be. I can just look back down at the outline. And don't feel like people are going to think you're less of a speaker because you have a piece of paper in front of you. They don't think badly of you. I have a very good reputation as a public speaker, and I always have something in front of me. Nobody says, wow, that was one of the most powerful talks I've ever heard, but the guy had a piece of paper. I mean, no one is going to say that. Now, I will say as a caveat that it is more common simply to read papers in their entirety at academic conferences and probably at professional conferences in various disciplines. So it's more excusable for you to do it in those circumstances. But even there, I would urge you not to do it. When I've spoken at professional conferences, well, generally, I have a paper that's too long for me to read, even if I wanted to read it. So I have to summarize it. So I get up there, and again, I speak extemporaneously. So don't do it even there, even where people expect you to do it, because again, you'll be the one person who didn't bore everybody to death. And it's great to be that person. I will say in parentheses, I used to speak with no notes at all. And I will admit that there is a real thrill associated with that. I mean, I'll be honest with you. That is thrilling. It's just you and the audience. You know, you with no crutch, with no security blanket, just armed with your knowledge and your wit, and you're going to conquer that room. That is a thrill. That's a rush for a speaker. I had to stop doing that. And the reason is, maybe some of you have heard this story. I don't remember how many years ago. It was at least 10 years ago. In fact, it may have been exactly 10 years ago. I was giving a talk remotely from the Mises Institute to a classroom, an economics class, at Suffolk University in Boston. And something very strange happened in the middle of the talk. I was talking about the Austrian business cycle theory, and I got partway through, and I thought about what I had just said, and I realized it made no sense. I realized that I was talking gibberish. So I apologized to the audience, and I tried to start again, and the second time it was even worse. I was more incoherent the second time than I was the first. And eventually I had to ask their pardon and excuse myself, and I had to discontinue the talk. And I went home, because what started to happen was, you know that feeling you get when your foot falls asleep? It's like a tingly, prickly kind of feeling. I had that feeling in my arms and my legs simultaneously. And I didn't know what was happening to me. I didn't know, is this what a heart attack feels like? Is this what a stroke feels like? I don't even know, because I don't know what those things feel like. But what I did know was it was terrifying. Eventually, I had to be taken to the hospital. And at that time, I had in the hospital with me my mother and my wife. And I didn't know who was who. And I had at that time, had we had the fourth child yet? I think we had, it might have been 2009. We only had three. I can't remember if we had three or four, but I could name only one of them. And I was terrified. I didn't know what was happening to me. They had to give me a sedative to calm me down because I was so terrified. I did not understand what was happening. And to this day, we don't really know what happened. They said it was not a stroke. You're fine. Everything about you is fine. The best they could come up with was a combination of exhaustion and dehydration. They could not explain it any other way. And that scared me. And I felt like from now, I just needed something to assure me that even if I start going a little loco, I have something I can look at to ground me again. So shortly after that, I had a speaking engagement at the University of New Hampshire, and I didn't do my usual thing with spontaneous jokes and witty asides here and there. I just plowed through the thing with determination to prove to myself that I could still do it. And I remember Scott Horton was there, and he said, "Wow, Tom, that was just such a great talk." And I said, "What are you talking about? It's like the worst talk I've ever given. I was just proving to myself that my speaking career wasn't over." So I hold on to that piece of paper now. Time management is important. You should stick to the allotted time. It's rude otherwise. You should stick to that time because the schedule, as people at the Mises Institute generally say, is a contract with the audience. And you should not throw off an entire event because you couldn't keep to your time. So one way you can do that, this is not a way I use, but it's a way that I recommend for people who are getting started. In your list of bullet points, write down timestamps at various points. Say to yourself, all right, by the time 15 minutes has passed, I need to be at this point right here. And by the time 25 minutes, I need to be here. And if I'm not, then maybe you have little asterisks next to some bullet points that in a pinch could be dropped without detriment to your overall presentation. So be prepared to dispense with some material in order to stay on schedule. There'll sometimes be a timekeeper who will tell you when there are 10 minutes left, 5 minutes left, 1 minute left, but that's not good enough. You need to be pacing yourself through the entire presentation. But definitely indicate to yourself things that you could, even though it's going to kill you to leave anything out of your presentation, you could drop if you absolutely had to. Now, how about this whole make eye contact with the audience thing? You get this a lot. You got to make eye contact with the audience. Here's the problem that I find with that. When I look around at people in the audience, occasionally I'll see somebody who's really bored or really agitated, like with arms folded and clearly unconvinced by what I'm saying. Somebody else is picking his nose. Somebody else is, you know, whatever. And I actually find that extremely distracting. So I think this is terrible advice. And I don't see how it wouldn't distract other people too. So what I do is, I don't want to look straight up. I don't want to look straight down. I look at the audience generally, but not at any one particular pair of eyes. Now, on the other hand, for all I know, I am looking at people's eyes because of my vision. You may not know I wear glasses, but I do wear glasses because I'm nearsighted. I can see things that are close up, so I don't need to wear them when reading. But things that are far away, so if I'm at a movie theater or if I'm driving, those are harder for me to see. I have to wear glasses. Well, audiences are far from me. And so when I look out in an audience, I see a big blur, and that's just the way I like it, so that there's no one person doing something weird who's going to distract me through the whole talk. So if I ever get LASIK surgery, this is going to be one of the things that I miss, is being able to look at an audience, have it be a blur, but keep looking at them so that I must be looking at somebody's eyes here and there, but in such a way that it doesn't throw me off. Everybody, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor, Hydrant. Now, I just went on, this very week, my first hike ever in my entire life. Can you imagine Tom Woods hiking? I'm in South Dakota this week, enjoying the free state of South Dakota. And when I started my day, I started with hydrant. If you wait till you feel thirsty, it's too late. You're already dehydrated. And you know drinking water has all kinds of great health effects. And hydrant makes it easy. It's a refreshing electrolyte powder you mix directly into water, more efficiently and effectively hydrates your body, keeps you going for longer. Each rapid hydration mix has the four essential electrolytes your body needs, sodium, potassium, magnesium, and zinc, and it really packs a punch. Comes in a variety of flavors. These days, my favorite is iced tea lemonade, but also if there's fruit punch, blood orange, and more. Refreshing and delicious, and I feel great after. Try it for yourself. See what I'm talking about. Tastes incredible, and it works. We've got a special deal for our listeners to save 25% off your first order. Go to drinkhydrant.com/woods or enter our promo code WOODS at checkout. That's DRINKHYDRANT.com/woods and enter promo code WOODS for 25% off your first order. drinkhydrant.com/woods and enter promo code WOODS to save 25%. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. So then other things, physical things about giving a talk, one of them is make eye contact. Another one you get is some of these courses will talk to you about how to gesture. And that's just not good. It's hard enough to give a good talk that has good content, good delivery, good pacing, connects with the audience, without also having to undergo these, to follow these robotic instructions about gesture like this, not like that, and then put your hand over there and look over. Don't do that. You know, why do that to yourself? When you're talking to your friends, you don't say to yourself, now, when I make this point, I should put my hand here and point, and then you don't, right? Well, why should you do that when you're giving a public talk? Just gesture the way it just comes naturally for you. But at the same time, you should always make sure to watch the recordings of your talks. Because when you do that, you'll see if you're flailing your arms around like an idiot. You'll get a sense that, okay, I'm overdoing it. I'll try to be more conscious of that next time. Or as well, not just physical tics like that, but you'll also become aware of verbal tics you may have. So, and I'm telling you, the audience picks up on those. Because if you're ending every sentence with, okay, there are a lot of speakers at the end of every sentence, it's okay, okay, and people are ready to jump out a window halfway through when you keep doing that, or ending it with right, or whatever it is. Or maybe you're saying, you know, too much, which I do. That's a problem that I have. Whatever it is, it's that's something that persists through your talk. You want to correct those. So it helps to critique yourself because you're not aware you're doing these things. That's the thing. These are things you're not aware of until you watch. But one thing you should not reproach yourself about, and that is the use of the word such as it is word. I don't know if it's a word, but or ah. I know somebody who says you've got to eliminate all that from your public speaking. I couldn't disagree more. We say or ah in ordinary conversation. It fills a little bit of space sometimes. It serves a purpose. Now, you shouldn't overdo it. That gets irritating. But if you do it two or three times in the course of a talk, no one's going to remember that, and nobody except a fanatic is going to care. And if you're trying to root out such a natural human habit, it's another thing that's going to make you crazy and make it hard for you to hold everything together. As I say, it's hard enough to give a good talk as it is without trying to uproot something that comes completely naturally to everybody. So don't worry so much about that. One more thing, though, about the physical thing, like about what to, how to gesture and stuff. It is true that sometimes we are unsure of what to do with our hands. Like when you see a musician on stage and it's a musician who's not also playing an instrument, he's got two free hands. So what's he usually doing with the hands? He's holding the microphone with his right hand and the microphone stand with his left hand. Now, he doesn't need to hold the microphone stand. That stand's not going anywhere. It's not going to fall over. He doesn't need to carry the microphone stand around with him on the stage. It's that what else is he going to do with his hands? He'd look like an idiot just standing there. So it's natural to wonder, what should I do with my hands? And if you're afraid that you might gesticulate wildly, a very respectable thing to do with your hands is simply to hold onto the lectern with them, one hand on one side, one on the other. That's perfectly natural, and you'll look in command and perfectly normal doing that. So that's one thing you can do if you are worried about this. Now, here's where we get to organization. How should you organize an effective talk? And I'm going to tell you the method that I use. But first, we're going to start with a don't. Do not start your talk with a joke. Now, I'm not saying never, ever, ever it's not an apodictic certainty that it's always wrong to start your talk with a joke. But I actually think it's an advanced tactic to start a talk with a joke. And here's why. And by the way, I think you may have, again, some of people who listen to me obsessively might have heard this, but Scott Horton gave a talk last year, and he started by saying, well, as Tom Woods always says, start your talk with a joke. And I thought, oh no, Scott, that's the opposite of what I say. I do start some of my talks with jokes. So this is sort of a case of do as I say, not as I do. But as I say, I've been doing this for a long time. And once you've been doing it for a long time, you can start with a joke. But here's why it's not such a good idea. Number one, everybody expects a joke, right? It's so formulaic at this point. You start your talk with a joke, everyone expects it. And you should want to stand out, not be predictable. But secondly, here's the real thing, real problem. What if your joke bombs? What's that going to do for your confidence for the rest of your talk, right? The thing that you thought was going to break the ice with them and it lands like a lead balloon? Oh, no, that's not good. And plus, that makes the audience feel like you're incompetent. Like you were rolling the dice, betting everything on this joke really landing, and then nobody laughs? Oh, then they start pitying you, and you don't want that. You do not want the audience's pity. You want their respect. Do not start with a joke unless you are absolutely certain that that joke will land. On the show notes page, I will have four talks of mine that illustrate some of the principles that I'm talking about here. And one of them is this thing about starting with a joke. It's the first one on the page will be a talk I gave in 2009 at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And there I did open with a joke I thought of like a minute before I went on stage. And this I knew would land because it was self-deprecating. People liked that. And it was also an opportunity for the audience to laugh at themselves. The joke was basically this. It was a Friday night. I was in town for a conference the next day. And as long as I was in town for a conference, I figured I might as well give a talk at the local university on the Friday night beforehand. And so I went up there and I was looking out at an audience that had packed that hall. It was packed. You could not seat one more person in that room on a Friday night to come hear me talk about economics. And so I said, ladies and gentlemen, it's not something like this. I said, it is a small sliver of the human population that hears the words, there's an economics lecture this Friday night, and decides to attend. Well, God love you people. Thank you so much. And they applauded and laughed. That worked. But it's very rare that you have that level of confidence that a joke is going to land. So I recommend instead, especially for a beginner, two other ways of starting a talk that are also very effective and can work even better than a joke. Start with a story. Don't even start with, good afternoon, everybody. Today, I'm going to speak to you about, don't even do that. Start right in with a story about somebody they've never heard of. They will be paying attention. People love stories. And what you're going to be doing here is more or less modeling what a lot of good nonfiction authors do. Now, what middling nonfiction authors do is they're writing a book about law enforcement and law enforcement abuse, and there's a chapter on no-knock raids. You could start that chapter, if you're like a middling nonfiction author, by saying, no-knock raids have grown in number over the past 10 years. They have been rife with abuse, and a great many people have had their lives turned upside down by them. Now, that's nothing wrong with starting your chapter that way. But it's much, much more effective to say, it was 3:37 a.m. Eddie so-and-so was lying in his bed alongside his wife of 17 years, blah, 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 blah. And then a loud boom. See what I mean? They start with the story, and then from there they say, you know, his life was turned upside down. But of course, he's not alone. This phenomenon affects a lot of people. That's much more effective. And so likewise, it's much more effective than you getting up in front of an audience and saying, law enforcement faces many challenges and sometimes they get things wrong. And one of the things that tends to be rife with abuse is no-knock raids. And they have been much better to start telling that story just the way I just did. That will draw them in. And that will give you confidence because once you tell that story and you see people listening, the next time you tell it, you'll know this story draws people in. Another way that you can start is start with a question. Start with a question that gets them thinking. And the point of your talk will be to answer that question. That is going to make you stand out from the sort of person who gives a talk that sounds like it's a fifth grade book report. I really enjoyed this book. My favorite character was. No, you're going to be different from that. Now, what's the overall structure of a good talk? Well, of course, it varies, but I'm going to tell you what mine is. I'm going to tell you the model that I use over and over and over again, and it just works. It's tried and true, and it works. There's nothing flashy about it, but it works. It works. The flashiness should not come from the way you're organizing it. The flashiness should come from the content and the delivery. But the organization can be very basic. And here's the organization. Now, it's actually very similar. The order is a little bit different, but the content is basically identical to how Thomas Aquinas answers the questions in the Summa Theologiae. It's almost identical. It's just I switch the order around. But what I, in effect, do is I raise an issue, I lay out my position on the issue, I give several arguments in defense of my position, I then anticipate objections to my position, I reply to those objections, and then I conclude. That is a great way to give a talk. That is much, much better. Now, when I get to the part where I'm laying out my argument and I've got my bullet points, this is where we come to what I call the greatest hits model of speech writing. A lot of times you read a book, and again, let's say it's about the police or something, and every eighth page, let's say, there's some unbelievable outrage. I mean, that makes everything else just seem like nothing. It grabs you. Every eight pages, there's another one and another one, a story or a fact or a statistic that blows your mind. Every eight pages or so, it's some, you know, maybe it's a really good book, but every eight pages, there's something that really blows your mind. Those are the things you're going to make note of as you're, because you should be reading frequently on the types of topics that you would speak about. And in the course of doing that, you should be making notes, have a notebook where you write down stories and facts, statistics that startle even you, even somebody like you who reads about this all the time. These are your greatest hits. So instead of plowing through a 300-page book and finding 10 things that really shock you, in the course of a 45-minute talk, you're going to lay out half of those in 45 minutes, and heads are going to explode. That's the greatest hits model. So on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1718, I give you two examples of me using this greatest hits model. Now, I named it that. Nobody else calls it that. You'll see this in action, exactly how it's done on that page. Now, as long as we're on organization, how about the ending of your talk? Well, maybe not at the end. Sometimes I actually put this at the beginning, but I'm thinking about what's the purpose of my talk? What do I want to accomplish with it at the end? I want to get people thinking, but I want to build a relationship with the audience. I don't want the talk to be the entirety of our relationship. I want it to continue. I want the conversation to continue afterward, which is another way of saying I want to build my email list. I want to get people on my email list in my talk. Now, you may not have a mailing list, which is a mistake. You should be building one. But even if you don't, then okay, promote. If you have a book on the subject, promote the book. If you have some service that's relevant to your topic, talk about your service. Give them some kind of thing to do afterward, right? Now, that's why I think that at the end of a documentary, there should be some call to action. Okay, now I have this knowledge. What do you want me to do with it? What do you want me to do? So I used to say, now listen, now that you've heard this, I want you to go, like I remember when I spoke before Ron Paul's rally for the Republic, I said, go join Campaign for Liberty. That was the action item. Don't just say he gave a nice speech. Go do this thing. Well, likewise, I say, look, I have a great ebook on this, and you can, and I want you to go read it. And I say, all you have to do is text the word blah, blah, blah to this number, and you get the ebook automatically. And I can, with one talk, I can get 80 or 100 more people on my mailing list. That's amazing, by just doing that. I use something called lead pages. I have the, I don't know what the names of the membership levels are, but I have one of the higher tier memberships there. And one of the features of that is that it gives you this really neat option where you can say, text the word blah, blah, blah to this number, and you'll automatically get this free ebook, and you get added to my mailing list at the same time. It's beautiful. It makes you look like the king of the universe. If that interests you, by the way, you can check that out. TomWoods.com/pages is my affiliate link for Lead Pages. I could not live without Lead Pages because it's how I build all the pages for all the ebook giveaways or all these single page sites that I have. I could not live without Lead Pages. But anyway, I want to accomplish something with the talk that allows me to keep communicating with them into the future. Okay, a few more things I want to say. Don't use PowerPoint. I forbid it. How do you like that? Everybody uses PowerPoint. It's a crutch. It's, for one thing, it's just one more thing that can go wrong, right? You're standing up there looking like an idiot while the tech guy is trying to get your slides to work. Ugh, why put yourself in that position? Also, you'll differentiate yourself. Everybody uses PowerPoint these days. Everybody. I get up there, that screen gets turned off. I am just going to talk to the audience. And incidentally, studies show that it does not help comprehension and can even inhibit it. So there's no good reason to use it except as a crutch for yourself. And that's not good. You don't want a crutch. You want to get up there on your two healthy feet. A Harvard study not too long ago concluded this. Using a real-world business scenario, PowerPoint was rated by online audiences as no better than verbal presentations with no visual aids. Okay, well, if it's no better, why are we doing it? Differentiate yourself. If you are the sort of person who feels comfortable in a room full of strangers, I know that there aren't that many people who fit that description, but maybe after listening to Anthony Samaroff early this week, maybe you feel a little bit better about that. But if you're the sort of person, you're just a social butterfly and you love situations like that, then arrive early at the event and work the room. Introduce yourself to people, talk to them, so that by the time you give that talk, you're going to be looking out at a lot of familiar faces, friendly faces, who are positively disposed towards you. And that can only boost your confidence. Another thing, larger groups are much easier to speak to than smaller groups. So don't be afraid that it's a lot of people. That's going to make your job a million times easier. It's murder speaking to 15 people. Give me 1,000 people any day. When it's 15 people, they don't really laugh at your jokes, you know, because the room's really quiet. There's no energy in that room. You say something funny, maybe one person chuckles a little, but then the others think he's weird. It doesn't work. It does not work. It's like the one time I went to Vermont, I ate at a Chinese restaurant that had no music playing. In case you're wondering, why is there always music in the department store or the restaurant, even just quiet music? Try it without it. And you feel weird. You feel like you're not supposed to talk. Like it's so quiet. You feel like you have to keep your voice down or not speak. It's weird. And same kind of dynamic is going on with the small audience. The big audience, you're going to have of 1,000 people, there are going to be people who, you know, at least a handful think what you just said is funny, and that's contagious. Other people, they're not thinking about it explicitly, but they suddenly feel more at ease laughing. They feel comfortable laughing. They're not going to look stupid laughing. And so that catches on. Or somebody will clap for a point you made, and then other people will clap. You're not going to get people clapping for a point you made when there are 15 people in the room. But if you ever see my speech before the Rally for the Republic, which was Ron Paul's sort of counter convention in 2008 in Minneapolis when they were nominating John McCain in St. Paul, it might have been, I might have it reversed. I think it was Minneapolis. But when that was going on, I was speaking to thousands and thousands of people. I could do no wrong with these people. They cheered everything I said. They laughed at my jokes, everything. It was unbelievable. That was vastly easier than speaking to a small group. Key thing, know your audience. Know their knowledge level so you'll know how to speak to them. Get a sense of their background. And again, I want you to look at my examples at tomwoods.com/1718. First example I'll talk about here is one I've already mentioned, the one at Boulder. Because there I knew, it's the University of Colorado at Boulder. You know there are going to be some left progressives in the audience. Okay, so notice the way I handled that talk. I did not use that talk as an opportunity to try to humiliate or belittle those people. I made some self-deprecating jokes, and the main thing I was emphasizing to them was not, you have to walk out of here being a proponent of the Austrian theory of the business cycle. What I was saying, though, was, what I'm telling you now is not obviously unreasonable, is it? It's not obviously preposterous, is it? And it does seem to have some explanatory power, if we're being honest, doesn't it? So at the very least, shouldn't we at least be talking about issues like this? Shouldn't the Federal Reserve at least be on the table for discussion? And surely can't we agree that it's strange that it isn't? That was all I wanted to accomplish there. And I feel confident that I did, especially because of the email follow-ups I received from people afterward. Second talk on the page is from Nullify Now, an event put on by Michael Bolden and the 10th Amendment Center, which he did all over the country. This is the one in Los Angeles in 2011. That was a room, was it 2011? It doesn't matter. I think it was 2011. That was a room that had all kinds of people in it. It had, you know, plumb line libertarians, but it also had, I saw people with Operation Desert Storm hats and stuff like that. Operation Iraqi Freedom, things like that. And I thought, okay, this is quite a mixture of people. And I had been planning to get up there to give a talk saying about what was wrong with both domestic and foreign policy in our day and age. And I hesitated and I thought, I don't know, maybe I better stay away from foreign policy given what a mixed crowd this is. And I thought, what? How am I even considering that? No, this is the exact crowd that needs to hear what I have to say about foreign policy. So notice how I handled that talk. I went out of my way to seem like I was on their side. And in some ways, I was. You know, that wasn't a put on. But in other words, I went out of my way to connect with them on issues where I knew we could find agreement, particularly on the domestic side. And they knew I was no commie, I was no leftist, I wasn't somebody who couldn't stand the sight of them, so that I was able to build up capital with them, which I then went on to spend. I spent that capital with them by then saying the foreign policy is just as bad, and here's why. And you people in this room especially, you should know better. And you're better than this. And you've fallen into this out of a kind of laziness because we feel like, well, you know, I guess I'm against Hillary, so it means I believe the following things, even though Hillary's terrible on foreign policy too. But I was saying that you should know better. You're the ones lecturing us about moral relativism. Well, what do we say about a policy that has horrendous results for human life? And that if the Soviet Union had done it in 1973, you people would be screaming. But it's the U.S. government, and so instead you're making excuses for it. That sounds like moral relativism to me. And you're better than that. And I wound up getting a standing ovation for that because I had the guts to talk to them that way. But I had built up, in a way, I had built up the right to speak to them that way by building up that, by knowing who they were, building up capital with them, and then expending that capital. So check them out. I've got those two, the Colorado and California ones, Boulder and Los Angeles, and then two others that illustrate my greatest hits model of public speaking that I think you can incorporate into your own presentations, certainly that model. All right. Well, that is it for today. I hope you found that worthwhile. TomWoods.com/1718 is the show notes page. And if you like and appreciate what I'm doing, I would be delighted if you joined me as a supporting listener. And just one of the many benefits you get is membership in the Tom Woods Show Elite, which is going to keep you sane during these truly insane times. So warm my heart, please, and head over to supportinglisteners.com, particularly if you keep hearing me say this and you think, yeah, other people are probably doing that. No. You belong there too, okay? You person who keeps hearing this and doesn't do anything, you belong there too, right? If you're enjoying this show, then you would fit right in and we'd be delighted to have you. So supportinglisteners.com is where to go, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.